Okay, thank you. So today I'd like to talk about what we can learn about spatiotemporal dynamics from numerical simulations of Rayleigh-Binard convection. And this is a big collaborative project at Caltech, Duke, also at Argonne National Lab, where we've made a pretty big effort to try and do realistic numerical simulations of Rayleigh-Binard convection for realistic in the sense of what you would do in the lab experimentally and try and make a connection. So what I'd like to tell you about today is how we're doing that, this numerical simulation approach. What can we really do in terms of mirroring what happens in the experimental lab? Then show you some of the problems that we've looked at so far. We've looked at chaos and small aspect ratios. One of the great things about numerical simulation is we can actually look at mean flows, which is very difficult in the lab. I'll tell you more about that. And so we looked at that for spiral defect chaos. And more recently, we've looked at the largest aspect ratios that we can do. An aspect ratio is the lateral extent of a cell to the depth. And what we've studied there is coarsening, pattern coarsening, coarsening of stripe patterns when quenched through a disordered state. And lastly, some provocative questions, hopefully leading into our informal discussion later today about rotating convection, some of the issues that are there, and some of the issues that I think we can help answer with these numerical simulations. And then just to point your attention to some of these other cases that we've looked at, but I won't talk about today, please go to our website or talk to myself, Mike, or Janet, or Henry Greenside, and we can tell you about traveling waves and rotating annuli. Also, we looked at passive scalar transport in spiral defect chaos, where you put tracer particles in. We've also looked at the growth of linearized perturbations in spiral defect chaos, but I won't get to any of that today. Okay, so Rayleigh-Binard convection, just the simple case of two plates heated from below. Eventually you cross, you get buoyancy-driven instability and you get convection rolls. And of course you can get much more complicated than that. This is the idealistic case of an infinite layer, straight parallel convection rolls. Okay, now we're able to simulate things like cylindrical geometries. So these are with the sidewalls, no slip sidewalls, no slip bottom surface, top surface. And these are this one is rotating convection and this would be non-rotating convection.
Are they insulating the sidewalls?
I think we can do either insulating or fully conducting.
Well, which one? I'm sure you can, but which one do you do?
I think for these two cases it's insulating. And so this is an example of domain chaos, and this is an example of spiral defect chaos. And let me just show you how they go. So this case here is when you take the entire convection layer and you rotate it about the vertical axis. And eventually you will get a chaotic state of patches of rolls at different orientations overtaking one another. And so you can see you get a complicated state. And I'll talk a little bit about rotating convection at the very end. Now in this case, when you don't rotate it, and you have Prandtl number, which is the measure of momentum transport to energy transport, about 1. For sufficient Rayleigh number, which is the thermal forcing, you get a chaotic state of spirals. And so these are full numerical simulations. Aspect ratio here is about 30, so the radius is about 30 times the depth. And so we're able to get full flow field information, look at mean flows, and try and understand these problems from here. So why study Rayleigh-Binard convection? Why go through all the effort to do realistic numerical simulations? Because these aren't small scale. These are all on supercomputers, a lot of effort. And really, the case that we would like to make is that if you want to make a quantitative comparison between theory and experiment for a spatially extended non-equilibrium system, Rayleigh-Binard convection has long been the canonical example, sort of the place to look. And so what we would like to do is make this connection between theory and experiment. For a long time, theory has looked at things like free slip boundaries, infinite domains, periodic boundaries, you know, and in the experiment, they have finite geometries. They do specific things at lateral walls. So making that connection between theory and experiment was very difficult. But now with numerics, when we can look at the precise geometries, we have access to the full information of the flow field, we can make that connection between theory and experiment. And in the examples I'll show you today, hopefully I'll convince you that we've been able to learn something by doing that for some specific cases.
I have a question. Is do you have no spiral at any rotation, or is it a critical?
There are spirals at certain rotations. And you'll see at the end, we kind of have a cartoon of a phase diagram of what you would see as you increase rotation. And you'll see the states that we think may be out there. And it's very interesting. There's a lot of different states. Okay, so personally, some of the questions I'd like to answer by looking at Rayleigh-Bernard convection are large aspect ratios, and I'd like to look at spatio-temporal chaos. And I'd like to be able to understand low-dimensional chaos versus high-dimensional chaos, things like sensitive dependence upon initial conditions, and this would mean calculating Lyapunov exponents or fractal dimensions and things like that. Things that we can learn from the numerics for experimentally realistic scenarios, but you can't necessarily make the measurements in the lab. And then you can start to ask questions like, can you control chaos? Can you borrow ideas from equilibrium physics to these non-equilibrium systems? And then at the end, how about transitions between chaotic states? So that's sort of the overarching goals in my mind. Okay, so this is just to get everyone on the same page. We're just looking at the simple Boussinesq equations. I call sigma Prandtl number, R is the Rayleigh number, and here's a Coriolis term when we include rotation. And energy conservation, mass conservation, and an interesting or important non-dimensional parameter is the aspect ratio in convection. It's as you increase the size of the convection layer, you get totally different physics. You go from low-dimensional chaos out to high-dimensional chaos. And so where we would like to go is to this high aspect ratio case, because when you go to low aspect ratios, it's actually very, very complicated. You get a wide zoology of states, and It's hoped that when you go to these larger aspect ratios, you'll get simpler physics or things that you can understand theoretically easier. Okay, so numerical simulations. We're using Necton, which is a code developed over 10, 20 years out at MIT with Paul Fisher and Tony Patera. They're fluid dynamicists who developed a highly efficient incompressible Navier-Stokes solver for parallel architectures. And so what we did is we took their code with the help of Paul Fisher and included buoyancy term and the energy conservation term to turn it into a highly efficient parallel Boussinesq solver. And what's nice about spectral elements is that just think of a finite element, just doing spectral methods inside of the in these elements. You can build any geometry you want. You can do cylindrical domains without worrying about polar singularities in the center of the domain. You can do things easy to add rotation. You can do paper fins at the sidewalls, which is one of the techniques and experiments to quench convection out near the sidewall. We can simulate that. Or another way to quench convection out near a sidewall is to do a spatial ramp in the layer height. As the layer gets thinner and thinner, the critical Rayleigh number goes down, or goes up, right? The critical Rayleigh number goes up, so you'll quench the convection, so you have a soft lateral boundary. And that's something we can do precisely with the spectral elements. Recently, there's been some work on elliptically shaped domains by Alan Newell, Nick Ercolani, and experiments by Gunter Ahlers. We can do full numerical simulations on elliptical domains. And so let me just show you a couple pictures. So a spectral element grid would look something like this. And this is a cartoon of one, because we don't really like these sharp areas like that. This is something I drew by hand. But this is what a cross-section of a cylindrical domain would look like. You get this sort of stadium idea, and you see that there's not a problem with a polar singularity anywhere. And so you could build any geometry you want.
And then, what do you mean by hand, or is that technical?
I literally went into a program and just drew this spectral element.
But, I mean, very strongly, you have four singularities instead of one, so you might do something to smooth that out.
Well, there's nowhere where a coordinate goes to zero. Like, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Those corners, I gather, are not really there.
No, we would smooth those out. Yeah. Oh, it's not very difficult. It's just difficult to draw by hand.
uh,
So paper fin, I mean, what I mean by that is if you look at a lateral sidewall and convection, sometimes they put a paper fin at mid-height to quench the convection. We can simulate that.
The other advantage is that you can actually simulate the sidewalls too.
Yes.
If the sidewalls are finite thermal conductivity, which they always have.
Well, that's something that we've been, we said we can do it if we want to, but we haven't actually gone to
but
that.
In principle, yet. You could do that. You
in
could
principle.
Actually have the bottom plate also active. You know, the bottom plate could actually respond to the temperature gradient in some way and imprint some pattern. I mean, if you have a weakly conducting boundary or something.
Right, in principle, we could do that.
That's why I asked you for about that, because probably conducting sidewalls are a better approximation. Because the activity of the wall is always much greater than that of the fluid.
Mm-hmm.
The fluid is a compressed gas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not clear to me either what we would really gain by going to these finite thickness, finite conductivity. We're talking about these lateral side boundaries, and we idealize them often by just making them perfectly conducting or perfectly insulating. In experiment, that's not the case, and in numerics, you really could put a finite thickness sidewall and go through the effort to calculate it correctly.
I'm saying that perfectly conducting is probably
good enough. Right.
Better than
right. For a lot of cases, we've looked at both, and we don't really, it depends on. So what I mean by a ramp, we can do things like ramp the bottom plate in any way that we need to. And so elliptical domains, this would be an elliptical domain, and you get this interesting sort of handle singularity in the middle, which has been recently studied. And so we can simulate those with the full equations as well. Okay, so just briefly, advantages and disadvantages of numerical simulations. To me, the advantages are we have our noise is roundup error. That's great. Another advantage is that we can look at these large-scale weak flows in convection, like mean flow. And what I mean by large-scale flow, I mean a flow that acts over many wavelengths, but it's very small, so it's difficult to measure in an experiment because it's dominated by this convective roll motion. We can pull out that mean flow and we can look at it, we can compare it with theory. This mean flow is something that's very important in a lot of the theoretical predictions for stability boundaries and things like that. And we can test those ideas. We can also vary aspect ratio and parameter space and the usual things. But I also want to point your attention to, we can also, this is something we're working on now, calculate Lyapunov exponents. So we can start to answer these questions about low dimensional chaos versus high dimensional chaos. This has been done for periodic geometries for spiral defect chaos by David Egolf and co-workers. And so we would like to follow up with that and do it for realistic scenarios, realistic cylindrical domains with the realistic sidewalls and see what we can learn from that. Okay, but there are disadvantages. And one of the things I'd like to just make clear is that there's a sweet spot in numerical simulations of Rayleigh-Bernard convection with current algorithms that are out there. And that sweet spot is about aspect ratio 60 to 100. You shouldn't think about just adding more processors or going to bigger computers and you can simulate bigger aspect ratio convection. That's not really the case because we have this diverging time scale. As you increase the aspect ratio, the time scales that you need to simulate for increase quadratically with that aspect ratio. Also, as you go closer to threshold, you also have slower time scales. But I'm not that pessimistic. If you pick your problem correctly, you don't need to simulate for long times. All I'm saying is that in many cases, experiments are much better for large aspect ratios when they can do long time scales.
I'm not convinced that gamma square dependence is always relevant.
Not always relevant, no.
Yeah, in fact, in many cases, I think for people's logics, it's really not that it's more the domain size. It's probably the truth.
That's true. For
for
these chaotic states, I agree that we wouldn't necessarily always think of this.
For complicated stationary patterns, it's more like gamma cubed than gamma squared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gamma squared is a simple phase of view, and then you have to have reorientation on top of that. You get much longer time scales.
So you have to really pick your problem smartly if you're going to do the simulations. And what also, we can't just wait 3 days if we wanted to let things settle out. It's not an option for us. So we really have to pick our problem well. I guess that's my point. Okay, so the first problem we looked at was small aspect ratio cells where Günter Ahlers in 1974 found chaos what was occurring. It was one of the first measurements in continuous medium like a fluid. However, it was with the liquid helium, so they weren't able to visualize the flow field. And some of the physics that was occurring remained poorly understood for some time. And one of those was, where did these power law dependencies come from? They measured the Nusselt number, which is the heat transport through the layer, as a function of time, sort of an integrated quantity. They took the power spectrum of that and found that for large frequencies that there were power laws. And so this brought up an interesting question about this chaos that was measured experimentally in the lab. Was it due to stochastic noise? And what I mean by that is thermal fluctuations or something like that. Or was it really deterministic chaos? And one can argue loosely that often when you see these stochastic effects, you would expect power law decay. And if you had deterministic chaos, you'd expect exponential decay in power spectra. So we went...
This
yeah.
is the large omega behavior.
Yes, large omega behavior. So we investigated this with our code. And so this is these are plots of the Nusselt number versus time. So each curve is for a different run. So these are for the precise aspect ratio and Prandtl numbers and sidewalls. Well, we used, I guess it was insulating sidewalls. And as you go in time, you can see these Nusselt numbers show different characteristics. So this would be periodic, and this would be more complicated up to some chaotic motion. Okay? So since we have the numerical simulations, we can go and look at the patterns. We can study what the defects are doing. We can see what defect signatures are showing up in these Nusselt numbers, look at the power spectra, and try and answer this question about these decay for large frequency. So let me just show you two of the simulations. So you're looking at a mid-plane slice like before. I didn't say this before, but red would be hot rising fluid, blue would be cold descending fluid. And so these are for aspect ratio about 5. And so this is the case where you get these periodic dynamics. And so see the familiar Pan Am patterns. You get dislocations nucleating in the center, climbing out to the sides. Then they slowly glide into a wall foci and they're annihilated. And one of the, like I said before, the small aspect ratio cases aren't necessarily the simplest to understand because there's a lot of complicated dynamics going on here. You can see the whole pattern wants to rotate. They're not, as you can see, like as these guys glide into the wall foci, get a large scale rotation. But eventually this pattern does settle down into periodic dynamics. So it starts to just repeat this. And in that Nusselt number plot, the periodic trace was for this simulation. So now as you increase the Rayleigh number, you get the more complicated dynamics, you would get something like this, and this would be the more, this is what you get for larger Rayleigh number. So it's much more complicated. You still get a lot of these roll pinch-off events, however they're occurring randomly in space and more randomly in time.
Mark, this is going to be one of the first cases where you try to calculate the alternate dimension.
That's what we were thinking. One of these lower aspect ratio simulations that calculate Lyapunov dimensions, where the amount of numerical work is lower, and we can
hope. Can you tell me what a Lyapunov dimension is?
What is the Lyapunov dimension? It's I consider it. You calculate the Lyapunov exponents, and using the Kaplan-York formula, you can calculate what a Lyapunov dimension is, and it's a measure of the amount of chaos. In the, okay, so we looked at our data and we found that we also found a power law. So this is the experimental results, a broad plateau, It's kind of in the power law. And this is our...
What is it exactly?
What it,
the P. What is the P?
What is the P?
Oh, it's the power spectral density of the Nusselt number.
Nusselt.
Of the Nusselt number, yeah. Okay, but notice this is where the noise floor was in experiments. And our noise floor is...
The average heat flow.
Yeah, I thought I did. Yeah, the Nusselt number is the heat flux through the layer, an average heat flux through the layer. Nusselt number is 1 when it's conducting.
Why do you think this is a good way to characterize this? I mean, why the Nusselt number?
Well, that's what was done in experiment.
So the direction changes in the direction of the heat.
It's kind of an average order parameter for the convection. It has a sharp n minus 1 is an order parameter. It's 0 when there's no convection, and then it rises from 0 squared.
So if you want an average quantity about the dynamics, Nusselt number has often been the parameter.
But he could have picked anything else, other variations that he wants to compare to experiment, and they have to be measurable.
Right.
Or maybe you don't consider it very important.
Okay, so but let's look lower. We have a much lower noise floor, and so we see this kind of behavior. So the power law dependence turns over into an exponential tail, which I can show you better on a semi-log plot. Here, so you see that it turns over to an exponential tail. So that's really
where's the power law now?
Up here.
It's also on the same straight line. Not quite.
Oh, up here too. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
So what does that mean? Well, we looked at the pattern some more, and we found that these power laws are due to when the roll pinch-off events occur. When the roll pinch-off events occur, you get these sharp triangular features in the Nusselt number. Okay, so and that would give you power laws, even in periodic dynamics. All you need is these triangular features. So that's where the power laws came from. And it's exponential decay means you actually have deterministic chaos. So if you do the same thing for the chaotic case, you would still get these power laws that would also turn over into exponential decay. So that was really, that was the first project I worked on. That was it was nice to say something about an experiment that had some unsolved questions that sat for many years, then look at it.
Crossover frequency corresponds to how many vertical diffuse times?
The crossover frequency between the power law and the exponential decay?
About one.
Yeah, that's right. That's about a
time. I guess we should have, I don't remember if we did, we should have sort of recognized that we were still, although it was high frequency, it was still below the characteristic frequency of these vertical diffusion.
Long
part
again.
That
sure.
Yeah, the
log.
This
is
vertical.
Well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder where I put this line.
Right.
No, I mean, the dot below the algebraic decay at about 50 and 100.
Well, if we really wanted to pin down that frequency, I'd need to draw this plot.
No, but the point is that if you didn't have, if you don't go beyond 100, mm-hmm. you still can sort of say
okay.
you have a power law.
Right,
and,
right.
And so we did say, well, we're on the order of the vertical diffusion time, and we're still seeing a power law. Well, we didn't go on.
Which unit your time is
this
order
is
horizontal.
The
vertical diffusion time.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the order of horizontal diffusion.
That's right.
If it's 100, right, for these small cells.
No. It's the other way. This is the frequency.
Oh, larger frequency, smaller time.
It's 100. The time. And that's the point. That that's the point. The natural thing to assume was that it's deterministic, and it's deterministic on the order of the vertical diffusion time. So if you get to shorter times or higher frequencies, it'll start bending over. Well, you have to wait till whatever. There are two pies and tens and 50 or 60, and that's why.
And by then, the noise is just six decades down.
Yeah.
From the maximum. You don't have a hope of measuring.
Yep.
That's right.
Right.
And that's the point of this.
Just saying, right. This is something you can do in the air.
Right.
And add something.
Right.
What? We haven't looked at that.
Yeah. I think that years ago we ever heard of the Lorentz equations or models like that.
They just showed that.
The exponential now rolls off to a power line, so it's the reverse.
So just summarizing again, I guess we already said these things. So we were able to use numerics to find the origin of the power laws and also to show the existence of the exponential decay and the fact that it's deterministic chaos. And so that's published here if you want to read more. So the next thing I'd like to switch gears now, the second problem we looked at was spiral defect chaos. And you saw a movie at the beginning of these spirals, and that's for low Prandtl numbers, no rotation, and you get this spirals of different chirality all interacting. And so this is low Prandtl number, so it's expected that mean flow is important, but it's difficult to measure mean flow. So we did simulations now of spiral defect chaos where we did something, I think, pretty interesting to the mean flow. But let me just tell you what mean flow is first. So consider this pattern here. Mean flow is operating in the horizontal plane across many convection rolls. Think of it as a weak, large-scale flow field. So it's on the order of a tenth to a hundredth in magnitude of the actual convection roll velocity, and it's occurring across many rolls. And you get these mean flows when you have roll curvature or amplitude gradients or things like that that occur in patterns, defects, etc. So these are just three sample cases of numerical simulations where we pull out the mean flow. And so here's one of these small geometries that we just discussed, on the aspect ratio 5 cell. And shown in the red and blue are mean flow potential functions, or vertical vorticity potential.
Strictly speaking, mean refers to time averages, but it is also, over many rows.
Yeah. Well, it's mean in the, I'd say vertical. Yeah. So really, when we plot these mean flows, all we're doing is integrating vertically the horizontal velocity fields. And that's what we call the mean flow.
All over the cell. So if you average the velocity of the cell under the row, you can
Right, and that's what we plotted here. And then we just made it easier to view by making them vorticity potentials. And so blue would be clockwise and red would be counterclockwise. So in the case of these small cells, you can see that the mean flow, which is, you know, everyone has thought this, conspires to compress the rolls in the center. So, you know, you have this mean flow acting like that and like that on both sides, and it's actually helping to cause these rolls to cross a stability boundary in the center and get these nucleation events. And so now we can, you know, calculate, we can measure what the magnitude is of the mean flows. And just to show you, this is what the mean flow looks like when you use one of these paper sidewalls. And so here I have, it's the lateral boundary, and then at mid-depth I have a paper sidewall that comes into this value here. And, you know, you can see that the mean flow extends out beyond where convection exists. And not much to learn here except that the mean flow is complicated when you have paper sidewalls. Also, here's a lateral ramp in the plate separation. And so the convection there also goes to subcritical, and the mean flow is extending out beyond those. I just wanted to show you three cases of where we calculated mean flows.
But maybe Mark should mention that Mike mentioned that if the walls are too narrow, according to Gustav, then this pattern is locally unstable. Mm-hmm. That causes then the generation of defects.
Right. Right.
So they are the kind of optimal distance or a band of distance.
Right, right.
And so defects appear if they
cross
the distance is too small, and then they pinch and cross, right. And
which would occur right here in time eventually. These rolls would get too small, cross the stability boundary.
Then the stasis MX.
Right.
You lose a roll, it goes all the way through.
That doesn't happen in reality.
No, no,
these two, there's time independent. So. Okay, so mean flow in really simple terms, there's two components. There's a local component that's due to the Reynolds stress term, u dot grad u, in the momentum equations. If you have any roll distortion or amplitude gradient, you're going to cause a mean flow to arise. However, the entire mean flow, the mean flow that you would measure, has to be solenoidal, has to conserve mass. So in effect, a pressure-driven flow, Poiseuille pressure-driven flow, arises such that when these two are added together, you get a mean flow that is conserving mass. So I think of the mean flow as having a local generating component and a more global responding component to that local component. So what we've done now is say, well, let's look at spiral defect chaos. Well, let's look at convection in general and ask if we can subtract off the force that's causing a mean flow to arise, in effect quenching the mean flow. So it's a virtual fluid. It has everything else being the same as what's an experiment. However, we're just going to take out the mean flow piece. So we can look at dynamics where we think mean flow may be important and see what happens when we take it away. Next slide. So for spiral defect chaos, here's, I'll show you what happens. Basically, we just subtract off the force that is going to lead to the mean flow in that next time step. And basically, it's just the vertical average of the horizontal velocity fields times a coefficient that has some theoretical dealings to do with, and it turns out to be 3/2. But when you do subtract them off and you calculate the mean flow numerically, it's completely quenched, and the rest of the pattern remains untouched. So what I'm showing you here is we simulated a spiral defect chaos state. So it's going, there's spirals, and it's chaotic. And then over here, I've quenched the mean flow. And so you can see that there is a distinct difference in the patterns. And I like to show you what happens when you quench the mean flow. So let me just show you a movie now.
Wait, can you take your second?
Okay, so there's spiral defect chaos. And then right about now, there you quench the mean flow. So you turn on this capital phi. The mean flow now is absent from the pattern. Spiral defect chaos, all the dynamics cease to exist, becomes time independent. The roll wave number gets larger, which means the rolls become smaller. And you get a lot of these angular textures. And we've even looked at what happens to the angle at which rolls terminate in lateral boundaries. Did you have a question?
Yes. Phi is adjusted at each time step?
Subtracted off at each time step.
No. This is the equation.
Mm-hmm.
You need to pick phi at each time step by the constraint that the mean flow at each point x, y is zero,
mm-hmm.
and that determines phi?
Well,
okay. So subtracting off some average of the u dot grad, subtracting off the driving force, and subtracting that average is determined somewhat empirically.
Right.
There's some coefficient that needs to be determined empirically. There we look at the setting the mean flow. So I think this is a local function of u.
Yeah. I understand.
So it occurs at every space point.
By minimizing the mean flow.
So at every point in space, we calculate the vertical average of u dot grad u times the coefficient, and you subtract that off of the flow field at every point.
You do calculate that from the previous time.
Yeah.
Set.
Yeah.
But in particular, if I calculate the mean flow for those patterns,
mm-hmm.
they're zero at every
mm-hmm.
at every
point.
Point. So you told me how you determine phi,
mm-hmm.
but that's just, you know, presumably we could determine phi anyway, as long as that equation leads to a u, which has no mean flow.
That's true. Right. So
you said that the wave number changed in the bottom corner, but it was as much less green.
That's because I use the same color scale.
I know. What that means is there's less weak amplitude regions. I mean, there's a big impact on the amplitude of the thing.
Amplitude is red and blue. Green is zero.
Green is zero.
Yeah. Right. There's much more zero in the left one than in the right one.
Right.
I could look at that, but I never.
It's not just pieces. If you measure the Nusselt number of both sides, you get very different numbers.
That's not the Nusselt number. The Nusselt number is the red and the blue. How strong is the connection?
Between the little zero,
plus or minus, that's a little zero between.
We did Nusselt number measurements.
You're just seeing the narrowing of the rules.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a.
They're narrowing in the rules, you see less green because it's.
It's more than that.
All right.
Okay, so here's a plot of the wave numbers. This is before spiral defect chaos. This is average wave number, and this is the thermal forcing, the Rayleigh number. And you see that when you quench it, it all collapses down onto the zigzag instability boundary.
What are the two symbols?
These are for different runs, probably different codes. We have a box code. We also have this Necton code that I'm telling you about. And these are.
And what's the dotted line?
The dotted line zigzags instability boundary.
That's the dashed line, but anyway. The
sorry.
Dotted line?
One of the other stability boundaries. Which one is it?
So those are stability.
Yeah.
Well, this simulation is, of course, the boundaries are not important. So you could do the same thing for a periodic boundary.
I would presume so, yeah. This is something we could do with Verner's code. So just to summarize, and it's written up here, it came out recently, so if you want to know the precise prescription that we're using and more details, please go to this paper. So in the absence of mean flow, so we think mean flow is important for spiral defect chaos. We think that we understand now that the mean flow changes the wave numbers. And in terms of this age-old question of rolls terminating into boundaries perpendicularly, it's not really well understood. I think what we can say from our simulations where we take out the mean flow is that the mean flow is important in that, but it's not the only component. So there's more to that question. I don't think we answered that question entirely. But we are able to say that when you take away the mean flow, the orientation of the rolls and lateral boundaries does change.
They become more perpendicular? No,
more oblique.
More oblique.
I mean, also, if you run this code and use Mike's old argument, you would never find a giant spiral which you think ought to meet, because that's a problem, the fact that the zigzag line or two lines were very different. In this case, it was more the focus line, which was this, and the defect line. Mm-hmm. So,
that's not just me.
No, without mean flow, the defect line, the other looks sort of, maybe we cannot show that we would not have a giant spiral for 100 number infinity. I think in your opinion, you can be I think you already showed it. You would not see.
Because
it's
better
than me.
Is it new? Yeah, no, but I think also that was your main point, I think.
Okay, so the next problem we looked at is, well, let's look at large aspect ratios. And that's aspect ratio 60 for us. And what we found is a pattern coarsening problem. And so what's interesting about pattern coarsening is that for equilibrium systems, if you quench a system through a disordered state to a state of straight parallel stripes, it's been studied for dye-block copolymers and things like that. And for the equilibrium case, you have a free energy that you can minimize, you can predict a wave number. And what's also nice is they can do extremely large aspect ratios where they have 100,000 rolls for very long times, and they can identify defect structures that are particularly responsible for this coarsening process. And by coarsening, I mean you start from many patches of straight parallel rolls and you end up with one big patch of rolls. And so there's competition, this role competition as you go in time. So, well, what can you learn from doing it in A? Or what are the questions you can ask for the non-equilibrium system? Well, we don't know what that long asymptotic state is. Is it stationary? Is it chaotic? What is the wave number? We don't have an energy to minimize. Do we have scaling? And scaling means if I measure different length scales in the problem as a function of time, do they all show the same asymptotic time behavior? And again, what is like the large scale morphology of the pattern? So these are sort of the general questions that we asked when we saw that we were getting pattern coarsening in these large aspect ratio simulations. And so transient dynamics, what happens is as the patches compete, they get slower, the dynamics get slower. And if you calculate some length scale and you look at how it behaves in time, you would get some kind of logarithmic behavior or power law behavior. So this is something that we would look at. If you look at more than one length scale and they all have the same behavior in time, that's what the scaling ansatz is called. And in equilibrium systems, oftentimes that's the case. So we were interested to know if in our systems, do we have more than one length scale? And so that's something we also addressed. So we looked at large by our standards. So I say 60, and if we really wanted to, we could probably get up to near 100. We're not able to simulate for very long times. Simulate times for vertical diffusion times, maybe 500, okay? So our main focus is on what kind of scaling do we get? Do we get slow scaling or fast scaling? We don't expect to be able to distinguish between a quarter and a fifth or something. If you read the literature, there's a lot of discussion about precise values of these exponents. We're not going to be able to answer that because of these limitations. Since our aspect ratios aren't very large, you would get finite size effects relatively soon. So we can't really talk about very slow growth or fine variations between these exponents. But we would be able to answer gross questions like, is the scaling slow or fast? So here's a simulation. This is aspect ratio 57. Lateral, no slip sidewalls all around. This is insulating sidewalls. And so let me show you this movie. So you start with random initial conditions. You quench the random initial conditions and you see that you get very, very complicated defect structure with dislocations, grain boundaries, wall foci, but an overall coarsening process is occurring. So here's a grain boundary that's receding out that would leave behind a patch of straight parallel rolls. So we went to study this this coarsening process. The Rayleigh number is too small. So if you increase the Rayleigh number, this would be a spiral defect chaos state.
Transient
spirals. What does that mean? I don't know.
Gunter, this Rayleigh number is too small to match with your last experiment, right? But wasn't your in the?
The old one, I don't know. Yeah.
No, but
the largest
menu is
1.4. So one of my hit.
Yeah, this carries over from these small aspect ratios. They all, in those liquid helium experiments, they also did an aspect ratio of 57. So.
Country's favorite number.
Yeah. So one of my hidden incentives in this talk is to convince experimentalists in the room to maybe look at domain coarsening, to look at large aspect ratio simulations, experiments.
You know, I find it a very interesting problem, but the practical problem we have is that the sidewalls always do something. When you turn the delta T on, you get lateral gradients
coming in.
You want to turn it on suddenly, and then watch the evolution, but you don't want to do anything so to make rolls coming from the sides, and that's very difficult.
Could you use a ramp? Would that help?
Yeah, maybe.
There's transient cycle forces. Some of the properties of the cycles are different from the
body. Paper fins, ramps, yeah.
Can you put in some kind of...
So this is just a snapshot in time, early time, late time. It doesn't come out very well on the screen showing small patches of straight parallel rolls, many defects, to larger patches of stray pillar wolves, also with quite a few defects of many different types still around, but less.
Is it clear that it ever gets stationary?
We can't answer that.
It,
that's a possibility that it does become stationary, but we don't know.
You mean that the, what exactly is stationary? You mean it's relaxing?
No defects moving.
We don't know.
Oh, if it's relaxing to a steady state,
yeah.
That's the question. Yeah. It's relaxing to a steady state. And the problem number is 1.4, right?
Yeah. No, but if you wait long enough, it will relax to a steady state, which might be dynamic.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Right. To a stationary.
Well, I mean to a time independent.
To a time independent. Stationary.
Stationary
state. Right. No.
We don't know.
There's no. That just depends on R. Right. and the boundary might be. Not very sharp because there could be extremely slow dynamics in certain.
And that will depend on the topology.
It might be no boundary. Because it's a boundary.
And I think it may depend on the particular topology of the defects. You might get stuck, you might get frozen states, you might get slowly relaxing states.
And this is one external filter that took maybe tunnel number 1.4 and maybe wavy number 100 or so. One day he saw a spiral defect case, and then he went on, and then the third day he had this cannon turn.
The long run, the monster.
Yeah, it was the extremely long run.
That was the
hockey
runner, the 1 year.
Yeah.
Did you add on
the experiment? Yeah, it was the question was this Hitler Steinberg.
So we measured the wave number as a function of time using the structure factor. And for two different runs, the red and blue curves are for different initial conditions. The dotted line is for what we had a change. We sort of did an incorrect restart at this point. So I wouldn't be 100% confident with this red curve, but it's being redone now. I just wanted to point that out to you. But what we'd like to say about this,
the red curve,
we have to do these restarts many times on these supercomputers, and there was something we didn't start with at the exact time that we ended.
Okay, no.
So it's something probably minor, but it's there, so I wanted to say that. And so the wave number looks like, this is an agreement with a paper by Cross and Myron, where they looked at a Swift-Hohenberg equation with mean flow and non-potential versions. Pattern coarsening seemed to have an average wave number that was going towards QD. QD is where motions of isolated dislocations become zero. And so we have a value of QD from Brendan Platt, one of your ex-students, one of Eberhard's ex-students, where he looked at a particular Prandtl number, and so I did those simulations, our simulations for the same Prandtl number. Yeah, that's why I picked 1.4. And so we, you know, seem to be going towards that same wave number. So maybe a wave number selection mechanism or a wave number selected by large aspect ratios is this QD value.
But it could shift to another value later.
Could
on.
Shift. Yep.
This is for cylindrical.
Cylindrical aspect ratio 60.
And how about the question of self-similarity? I mean, you take an average.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a self-similar correlation function? Is there a scaling?
I'm not sure what you're asking. What
so
you
that's
mean?
A structure factor.
Yeah.
Change shape is a function of time. Of all times can you fit it?
Yeah, we need to do that. I'll show you that in the next slide. We looked at the structure factor.
Okay.
And so, okay, the wave number selection aside, we also looked at correlation lengths and different length scales and looked for the scaling question, I guess, that I think you were asking. And so if you take the structure factor, which is just the Fourier intensity, taken as a mutual average, you would get something like this. The blue curve is from the simulations. And the red curve is a Lorentzian squared fit. And so the peak of this tells you...
Lorentzian squared?
Well, it works pretty well, and also that...
Yeah, I mean, the Lorentzian squared Hohenberg...
structure factors, doesn't have the square.
This is directly from the Swift-Hohenberg papers, this yeah. form.
The whole thing's square?
Mm-hmm.
So there's two squares.
There's
three squares. So it's an eighth power.
This is not from the equation.
No, this is not right. Because no, that would have S of Q going as Q to the minus 8 at IQ. And this is Q to the minus 4.
So get
not the Kalmberg.
So it's empirical.
So you would recommend looking at it without the square?
Well, I don't know. Depending on what you want to do, but if you go square way, you should say that this is an empirical function to fit the data.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Right. Not that that Swift-Hohenberg should be right because that's for the linear equation. So knows what it is for the non-linear.
It's not a very good study.
Well, we did it without the fit entirely also, and the results don't change. So we could do it just strictly by taking the second moment of the structure factor, and we would get the same result.
The blue is data?
The blue is data, red is fit. And so what you get out of this curve is the peak is where the average wave number occurs in the field, and this width here gives you an idea of the size of the domains, because for small times, you would get a very broad peak. And then for as time evolves on, this peak becomes sharper and sharper.
Does it really describe the size of the domains? Because I mean, this EQ there is very, very small.
It's not precise. But
if you look at the picture, you see much larger domains. Probably the eye, same if they don't pick up from this number.
You see there, but there's this one point. Okay, maybe Bill doesn't give up. So what you would find is that the wings of the column are limited by the left and right-hand side of the booster. Typically, there's a limit, which is a possible instability on one, so like it on the other side. And maybe then the kind of way to say that the pattern chooses an average Q in such a way that it avoids both these instability lines. So this is a maybe, okay, but this is certainly a nonlinear effect. Mm-hmm. This curve is determined by stability of nonlinear patterns. Seems so. Mm-hmm. And this is not built in with this linear structure.
Yes.
But this, this is something with the linear property. Without the square, it would look like it.
I don't know that I agree with that because I mean, the tails do extend beyond the boundary stabilities and then they cause formation of dislocations and God knows what and all
the dynamics. But I always feeling that these two lines just
we also know the structure that the structure function doesn't mean structure
function
factor.
Right.
It's just the
average,
but these are non-linear effects.
All we wanted to pull out of this is a length.
I'm concerned that if you start looking in detail at things like we're going to talk later on about finite size effects and whatnot, I'm worried that this delta Q is going to be influenced by the form of the structure factor.
Well, we also did the same diagnostics by just taking the second moment of the structure factor without any curve fits, and the answers are all the same. The reason I chose this is I kind of like having something to fit to the data. But I did everything without the fit, and the answers don't change. It was supposed to make it better. Okay. So you plot the length that you get out of that, inverse of that delta Q versus time, and you get what one could call power law behavior. But note that it's over two decades in time. And so we're getting consistent behavior here with very slow power law behavior, maybe a slow coarsening process by using the structure factor. So again, the red and the blue curves are for the same simulations, just starting from different initial conditions.
So my question about self-similarity, I think, would be, is the fit more or less equally good as a function of time, mm-hmm. or do you see that there's a distortion of
shape? Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at that.
Yeah,
that's something
that might be a relatively subtle.
Yeah.
If you just roughly speaking, the answer is yes. A single length like this mm-hmm. more or less describes the pattern, but how good the self-similarity yeah. is, whether you can really get collapse
right.
of data, independent of what the shape is, right. that you get a shape that collapses with a single length, which is a function of time. That's another kind of empirical yeah. way of.
And that's what's done.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sampling the shape.
And that's what's often done in the papers where they do the equilibrium case. They
right.
they show this
yeah,
collapse.
That's yeah. exactly yeah. right.
Because you get a power law without having scale.
Right.
You gotta be really careful when you measure these SFQs.
Yeah. Right. So we'd like to go to bigger aspect ratios, longer times. Well, let me show you that there's some other length scales that we looked at. Okay, so we also looked at orientation correlation length by using angle. And so we just did the second moment of the structure factor for angle now instead. And so this is one of the patterns, and then this is what the angle field would look like. So different colors indicate different roll angle. And so we plotted that as a function of time. And we find that we get faster growth. So the angle correlation shows a much faster growth than the structure factor growth. So this indicates the presence of possibly two length scales in the problem, which would not be the case for equilibrium cases. So faster growth, two length scales is probably what I would just pull out from that graph. And then the third thing we looked at was, well, let's look at defect density, and let's try and calculate a length scale based on that. And so we use the local wave number technique of David Egolf and others, and Melnikov. I don't know if he's in here.
There he is.
So we calculate the local wave number, and then from there we calculate a local curvature. And then we look at where curvature spikes, where we have high curvature. It's not the most elegant way of calculating defects, but it is a way, and it's effective for our purposes here. So what I show you here in red are defect-free regions, and in black are where defects are located. Black and white, sorry. I'm still thinking about the last picture, last graph. So this is an early time, so you have many defects everywhere. And then as time proceeds, you have these defects much less, the density is much less, and they also seem to line up. And these lines tend to be where the grain boundaries are. And these isolated defects tend to be where isolated dislocations are.
So to do this, you put an arbitrary threshold for
curvature.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where your threshold is doesn't make much difference, I
suppose. There is some art in picking it, but it's not, once you find where you're grabbing the dislocations, then it doesn't matter. But you do have to pick the general area correctly.
You find other things besides dislocations, I assume.
Grain boundaries.
Grain boundaries, dislocations, wall foci, things where there's just.
Is this more robust than using a face?
No, the face way is probably more robust.
Well, but this is much faster.
This is much faster.
Much faster.
Yeah. So one thing we'd like to do in the future is maybe track defect motion, and then we'd probably use the way you guys did. Okay, so then you can pull out a length scale from that, and so this is the defect density as a function of time, so that many as defects are going away in time, and you can pull out a length scale from that. If you think about the defects all lining up in a straight line with a width of 1, then this power law of about 1/2 gives you a time scaling of t to the 1/2. So this is showing that the defect structure is also on a fast a time scale. Okay, so what have we learned? What can we say about pattern coarsening? I'd say that a lot of work has been done in the equilibrium case. Not a lot of work has been done in the non-equilibrium case. The non-equilibrium case is very difficult. There's not a free energy. We're not sure which defects are important. It's very complicated. But we have been able to answer some things, like we think there's evidence for two length scales in the problem, a fast scale and a slow length scale. We think that there may be a wave number selection mechanism for large aspect ratios going towards this value of where the dislocations become motionless. And like I said before, I would be very interested in seeing some experiments where they can push out the aspect ratio as big as they can and run maybe some experiments for long times and see if we can confirm any of these preliminary ideas.
So,
yes.
I mean, it's a little misleading to talk about equilibrium and non-equilibrium. What you really mean is if you're relaxing to a state which is governed by a Lyapunov functional and one that isn't.
Right. You're coming from non-equilibrium to equilibrium.
Well, to a state whose steady state is governed by a Lyapunov functional, and if your non-equilibrium state is approximately, probably never will be exactly governed by a Lyapunov functional.
Right.
You might, there might not be a single answer for non-equilibrium. There might be an answer for when there's a Lyapunov functional, and then many answers when there isn't. And if you're very near, if you almost have a near threshold for a large Prandtl number or something like that, then you would be maybe dominated by the behavior, so-called equilibrium, the behavior when really relaxation.
That's a distinct possibility that the answer will be very complicated.
So you investigate. That's what was in the Miron paper.
Not precisely how what happens to approach it.
No, but the distinction that you can do with simulation.
Wouldn't these experiments be best done with liquid crystals? We can get the aspect ratio of several thousand.
Yeah, Rayleigh Bernard might not be the best place.
Are there any previous data on that?
Michael Bennett has done some work on aligned dynamics. Sigma mosaic domains that force.
So does the anisotropy bring in different time scale that's not expected to play a role?
I think he mentioned T to the 1 quarter.
That's right.
Mike is here tomorrow.
Mike?
Mike is
here tomorrow. When you had some of your states, you had, did you look at the mean flow in that state?
No, we haven't looked at the mean flow.
There's this very intriguing observation in the original paper by Mumbles where he maybe was the first to propose these models. And it tells a lot about causing. But what you would find is you would run the system and then the system has causing. And then you would be happy and it did not move. And then you look at the mean flow. And then the mean flow was not equilibrium. So it means it was just opposite to the mean flow you would expect from curvature. So from that you saw the system is not equilibrium. And then you would just continue his runs. Nobody would have done otherwise if you would have looked at the mean flow. And then after three times the original run, the pattern has rearranged, but at that time the mean flow was correct. But the final pattern, it looked just almost the same as the one we saw before. But there was another very, very slow process involved. Because
that's possible.
So frustrated.
Yeah.
And we
saw this.
It was very interesting to see how he went on, very detailed.
But we don't have the option to just run it out, which is a problem. But we also
can
look at the mean flow.
And see if it corresponds to the
steady state curvature thing. And maybe there are also here some surprises. There was always concerned about when I looked at this paper that something could happen also in other places.
Yeah. We saw this in the smaller aspect ratios. You could see the pattern would look like it's steady.
Yeah.
But you know, you just in the smaller aspect ratios, we could just run them out for long times, and after a long time, it would suddenly just you know have a dynamic state, and that was the mean flow related. Yeah. Okay, so now I'm just going to ask questions of you. Rotating convection. If you take convection layer and you don't rotate it, you increase the Rayleigh number, you get stripes. Okay. But if you start rotating it more and more, you pass a Kuiper's-Lorentz instability and you get domain chaos. And this domain chaos is what you saw in one of the earlier movies. And it's a supercritical bifurcation directly to a spatio-temporal chaotic state. And it's precisely where you would expect that we could say something theoretically and make that comparison with the experiment. And I'll show you in the next slide that there are some really interesting questions there that are ready, I think, to be understood. But also, in response to one of the earlier questions about what happens with do you get spirals when you rotate and things like that, this is our cartoon idea of what a phase diagram might look like as you increase the rotation rate, and just in two dimensions, rotation rate versus Rayleigh number. There's domain chaos, you have spiral defect chaos, and you have maybe stripes, and then you have transitions between chaotic states. So rotating Rayleigh-Bernard convection is an excellent ground to study the phase transition between chaotic states. And there's also the great possibility of unique chaotic states that haven't been found before. And there's some weak numerical evidence based on generalized Swift-Hohenberg equation for large rotation rates, large Rayleigh number, that there may be a locked domain chaos state.
You mean by that?
Chaotic domain chaos, where the rolls always tend to pick the same three angles.
Oh, it's exotic. It still has dynamics.
Yeah, yeah. But the angle seems to be locked. Right. So this was done a while ago in Swift-Hohenberg, generalized Swift-Hohenberg. But
the numbers of left and right rotating spirals is different. And the ratio follows an exponential now, time t to the minus omega square, something like an effect that has been worked out by Gunther of Eck. I think nobody really understands it. Or maybe. But
so you're talking about up in here.
They look just at the average for TC. And if the average was not zero, and you could also look at the average vorticity, some sense as a function of rotation, and you would also find a kind of exponential law.
So the case, though, that I would like to talk about next is this domain chaos. And I think that'll be what we'll talk about in our informal discussion later. But let me just give you some of my thoughts on it. So like I said, it's a supercritical bifurcation directly to a chaotic state, somewhere you know you think you could gain a lot of insight by doing theory. And the first theoretical approach by Mike Cross and Yuhai Tu, using Ginzburg-Landau models, predicted certain scaling behavior. And the scaling behavior that everyone thinks about are the size of these domains and the switching frequency. And that's how, if you sit at one place, how long do you wait until rolls come through of a different angle? That's this domain chaos where we have patches of rolls at different angles overtaking one another. And so this is the domain length, and then this would be the switching frequency predicted by Ginzburg-Landau theory. And then this is what's been found in experiment by Gunther Ahlers and others. So why are these different? And one thing that we need to consider is modifying the theory to include more of the effects that we're seeing in the experiments and in the simulations. Another possibility is finite size effects. Finite size effects, I mean, is how big is the aspect ratio of the cell, and does that make a difference for these scaling arguments? It's possible that thermal noise is important in the experiments, something that's not in the simulations. Also seen in experiments and in simulations are dislocations that are coming in from the boundaries. There's been three words, I've heard them called daggers, scars, or birds. So we need to maybe include that in the theory as well. So what can we do with Necton, though? So these are the questions. These all can't be answered by numerics. But what can we do with this Necton code? Well, we can look at finite geometries. We can look at this finite size effect. And we can look at these dislocations and scars and daggers. So here's a simulation of domain chaos. And so what I mean by these scars or daggers are these green dislocations that are gliding rapidly through the convection layer. So I'll show you a movie in the next slide that just shows the motion of these dislocations. I just wanted you to see the pattern itself first.
I've never seen a big, there's also mean flow, though,
is there mean flow?
Is there mean flow? Is there not? I mean, what about the very round of the field?
There is a mean flow. There is a mean flow. But it's very complicated. Well, wherever you have all these defects, you'd have some complicated
mean. Yeah. Butterflies and that's. Mm-hmm.
But if the puns on the speaker, they are not more strong because the grains are bigger and so on.
So here's if you just pull out the defects using the method I told you earlier with the local wave number technique. So you can now see distinctly yellow these daggers moving through the flow field. And they seem to be originating from the boundary. Mm-hmm. So, well, another thing we can do in simulations is remove the effects of boundary by doing periodic geometries.
What's the aspect
ratio? 20.
Is there a well-defined velocity that we can understand? Those things look like they're
they look, that's a good question. I don't think we've pulled one out. Do you know, Janet? This is a lot, it's very preliminary. But you're right, it does look like it's a constant velocity, and that would be a good quantity to pull out. And so we can also look at periodic geometries. And so now this is just a periodic box. And one thing you'll notice, I think, is that the domains themselves are bigger, and you get less you don't have defect generation from the lateral sidewalls. You still get these dagger structures. So this is something that we could address with numerics.
And what made you say that they originate at the sidewalls in the previous case? I don't know what you why you said that, but whatever reason you had, what do they do here?
Well, the previous one, they seem to be coming from almost from wall foci. It's emanating from these wall foci.
And they don't hear.
And here it's like you have straight rolls that are becoming Cooper's Law unstable, and as they rotate, defects are formed.
But when you look at this more carefully, there is a sense in which when the walls were curved, they originated at the mm-hmm. walls. When the walls aren't
there,
they don't.
When there are walls, they were doing both. Both things are going on.
That's why I was afraid that maybe they looked as if they did originate at the non-walls.
Yeah.
But you haven't quantified that, have you?
No.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I should just make it my issue. The early work with Yu-Chan Wu and Bob Ecky it's at the smaller omega where you can see better what's going on because things aren't also confusing. Mm-hmm. We had the impression that dislocations were generated at the sidewall in the experiment and traveled with a speed into the interior and therefore would be long range. And that caused us to be very concerned about whether the interior dynamics was influenced by what mm-hmm. was born at the sidewall. Now, that motivated the experiment with the radial ramp. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the very reason for doing the radial ramp experiment. And that experiment, Nathan will talk a little bit about it. The experiment gave the same scaling of the correlation as the system with sidewalls. So I'm pretty well convinced that that is not the problem.
This animation here strongly suggests that you don't have domain walls propagating across. This is not a.
That's another issue. You look at generalized Swift-Hohenberg simulations, and you really see domain walls moving around. When you look at the simulations with the full equations or in the experiments, it doesn't look that clear.
This is really complicated.
There's certainly one ingredient in this situation where the dislocation would not climb, but it would fly, mm-hmm. generally speaking. Mm-hmm. and we know that these locations collide, which have opposite polarity, we'll just try the pattern in a very effective way to adjust the pattern model, having great pattern with different angles which produce these locations, they collide and correct the pattern in total. And therefore, rotations, okay, in this case, it is not so surprised that this location will do this, and they do it in order to select the pattern. The pattern selection mechanism just by the dynamics of light in this location. And that is in deep crystal, we have studied this in detail.
So I think we've discussed this. And thank you all for staying so long. I mean, very nice. These conclusions are, I think, that by doing these realistic simulations, we can learn a lot about experiments. We can learn a lot about theory. We can help both theory and experiment move forward. I think that we're now in a position now to study a lot of interesting problems in spatio-temporal chaos and extended systems. And I hope that we're successful in that. Thank you.
Questions?
I had a sort of a naive question about that last movie that you made.
The periodic one?
Is there a way to tell the difference between dislocations and the superposition of two states? Because in my trying to understand movies like that, I made a movie that looked similar to that just by taking a set of straight rules and then superimposing over time a new growing set. And you can see defects grow in the exact same way as that last movie, but there's no defects. It just superposition of two states.
Well, there are defects. Well,
there
around them, you get a phase jump.
Right, but is there a difference between the superposition of two different role states and just having a pure defect in the role structure?
Grain boundaries are intrinsically, they don't match up.
Question whether the internal dynamics with the domain is the appearance of defects or whether the defects are really determining the dynamic.
I've asked that question myself because in this Kupers-Lorentz stability, a lot of times these defects, you see a sort of a checker pattern appear before, and that's not really a dislocation. That's something else. It's a tough question.
Right? I mean, if you superimpose two loads at 60 degrees, you'll get exactly that pattern.
But I think what motivates Nathan's question is that the Kupers-Lorentz instability is an instability plane wave parallel roles, and that instability occurs at some angle.
Right.
And initially, it's a superposition of a small amplitude wave at that angle onto a wave at this angle. And then the amplitude of the new one starts growing, and you start seeing this checkerboard.
You ever see that?
Yeah, we see that in experiments, and I'm sure you see
that. That last movie is exactly what I'm talking about.
I wouldn't say all the time, but some of the time. Other times you seem to see a bubble grow out, and other times you seem to see the screen.
And in what what is the relation of that discussion to the mechanism that Werner talks about returning role?
This mechanism is there.
Those are just distinct ways of maybe initiating roles at a different angle.
Yeah, I'd say that.
The superposition might lead to weak spots where there's just a bump.
I have a question about the computing. The computing. So you run these things on a supercomputer somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Everywhere.
What is the first of all, this costs a whole lot of money each run.
To someone, to the taxpayers of America.
You get a grant to do that.
For those of you interested in this, you would the supercomputer centers around the country, you submit a proposal. It's not too painful, and you get a grant for a certain amount of time.
You don't pay out of your DOE?
No, it's all taxpayer money, yeah. And so the scale of the simulations are, so let me just tell you, if you wanted to do a aspect ratio 100 cell for a horizontal diffusion time, which we all agree you might not ever want to do, it would take 60 days on 1,000 processors full time. And so you would never get that grant. But
so
these
thermals are really cheap.
Yeah, so
yes.
That's why when I look go see Nathan's experiments, it's just I'm jealous. But the simulations that we've looked at, these larger aspect ratios, aspect ratio of 60, and you run them out for 500 diffusion times, vertical diffusion times, that takes about 4 days on 256 processors at a supercomputer. So that's the scale. And the smaller ones, like the aspect ratio 5 and 20, you can really get away with 16 to 32 processors. And so then you're in the realm of Beowulf clusters at labs or even, you know, even serial jobs. And so
this depends on the how these arrays of the computer are arranged. Are they 2D grids, or how do you...
The computers? Yeah. It's independent of that. The algorithm is independent of... Well, we never worry about the architecture of... It's been optimized for different architectures, I guess was what I should have said. And so the IBM SPs all have similar architecture, and so we would optimize it for that. That's something that Paul Fisher is really excellent at.
But I mean, Mark, I find that, you know, a little bit surprising. We just had a colloquium last Tuesday with this guy from Rosella, that's right. They talk about these big clusters that cost $150 million and then run at, they hold soon now, to 200 teraflops.
Yeah.
And do the complete simulation of a meteorite impacting, and they all actually go and fly up for miles and everything all over the place. It's much more complicated than really the NASA convention.
Well, it's the problem. We have...
Because they have no experiment to compare it to.
Well, that was sort of part of my question, too. What is the outlook? Because things that were not doable 5 years ago, right, are now not only doable, but in lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. So what is the outlook for this kind of, for just from expected improvements in technology?
Okay. Well, first, Gunter's question. The problem of Rayleigh-Bernard convection is a really tough numerical problem because of a very thin, long-range correlated simulation. Incompressible Navier-Stokes is notoriously difficult because every piece of the flow field depends on every other piece. And so a lot of these other simulations can get away with discretizing the problem up into various segments and putting them on different processors. But our whole simulation has to move together. And it's a tough numerical problem, these long, thin layers. And I think the outlook is until we get better numerical algorithms, which is something.
This is one point. See, our codes are, they cannot do this, but they are 10 times off. We do it on a small, on one processor, and in spiral decay chaos, we have lose just a factor of 10 compared to the experiment. Because we never use a supercomputer, and all these things one can do it on this periodic boundary. You have much to, the resolution in the vertical direction is too big.
So I think that the current algorithms out there, so if you just stay with Necton and Necton technology and you let computers get bigger, I think you're really not going to get better than aspect ratio 100 forever. It's just the nature of the problem. But if you get better algorithms, which is something a lot of people are working on, to do things like Michael Lewy and Mike Cross did and Swift-Homburg, have like a fully implicit solver where you can take very large time steps, which is something that's sort of cutting-edge Navier-Stokes type numerical approach. When that becomes available to these simulations, that'll really open up,
I think
the possibilities.
Your time steps are a factor of 100 smaller than the one you
do. Right. Right. I just wanted to comment that.
I should mention just.
Wait,
I don't go there first.
I got a comment. Time and space are not symmetric in these simulations. You can go to very large domains by going to parallel computers, by carving up your spatial domain into regions, and then solving each of those regions on separate processors. Time cannot be broken up in such a parallel way. And so the overwhelming difficulty in improving these codes is how to improve the efficiency in time. There's basically no future improvements, algorithmic improvements in space that would be. The Necton code is basically an optimal spatial code in the sense of resolving flexible boundaries in an efficient way. So in the outlook, in my understanding is that if we're lucky, we'll be able to improve the time algorithm by a factor of 10 by what's going to require some major numerical investigation, numerical analytic investigation, how to make these codes implicit. But then that's it. And then the ability to simulate the future will be dependent purely on the hardware as opposed to algorithmic. There's probably room for a factor of 10 if one works really, really hard to change the time integration algorithm. But there's no improvement available for improvement in space. That's purely dependent now on how many parallel processes you have. So in the near future, I think the best we could hope for is maybe a factor of 5 to 10 speed up in time. So that's very useful. But the horizontal diffusion time now becomes a factor of 5 less than simulation time. But there's no bolt in the blue breakthrough in numerics that's going to suddenly make aspect ratio 500 accessible. We just have to go to a bigger parallel
computer. I think we should also make the state that we don't want to simulate infinite domains. We just want to simulate a big enough domain. And we're getting to the point now where we can get to domains that are big enough so you can start to think of them as large aspect ratios. We're at the cusp of that, I think.